I think we can think about that distant future somewhat similar to much of humanity's past, where the indentured rich, if you will, didn't have to work, but yet found meaning in the arts and in science and in learning and what have you, because they had slaves or serfs. And in the future, the AIs and the robots will be those slaves and serfs. The incredible anxiety people feel when they're canceled, why would that be? It's because you've been rejected by the tribe. Back in olden days, it's kind of astounding that society considered it as bad as the death penalty to be banished. I think technology is synonymous with progress.
Yeah.
They are one and the same, especially if some people define technology to include the things that we've invented in terms of social construct. Yeah. I don't think it is possible to overstate his contribution to humanity.
Really?
I've never heard a statement from anyone that says, oh, that overstates it. I believe he's the greatest hit of the American dream, writ large, like bar none. Immigrant comes to South Africa, changes every industry that he looks at with great success for the better.
For those that follow the podcast, y'all are probably familiar with Steve. Steve's been around the game for a long time. He's one of the greatest venture capitalists from my perspective. He's been at the forefront of a lot of core technologies. He's been a big investor in Elon Musk, which I know a lot of the audience follows. One of the main reasons why I brought Steve on is because it seems like he has a very good understanding of what's happening in the future and how the future is likely to evolve in the next 20 years. And one of the things that I try to do is I'm trying to understand the now and then trying to say, okay, next 3-5 years, what is it going to look like? You know, into like from a logistics perspective on how society is likely to adopt technologies, how technologies are likely to evolve, you know, and investing is one of the things I love to do. And I feel like to be a really good investor, you should probably understand what the future is probably going to look like, because, you know, the future sort of is like, hey, this is what the companies are going to exist. So I'm just going to start with the big question and we'll go from there. So we were briefly talking before we started recording. All of us are aware of, you know, some of the latest current events around the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And we know that's sort of like, I feel like a percentage of the population has sort of has some PTSD from that event, you know, as any sort of major sort of thing like that happens in society. But I kind of want to talk about how we're going to progress as a society in the next 5 years from the known disruptions we're going to get from technology. And that's kind of where I want to pick your brain. And so I'll sort of frame my question this way. It feels like, at least in the United States, or let's say in the Western world, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of just chaos a little bit. There's a changing type of order. And I don't know if you would agree with that, but it just feels volatile. And in that volatile sort of foundation, we have this game-changing technology that's going to fundamentally disrupt labor. And when that happens, it feels like we have a recipe for a lot of just upheaval potentially. And you know, and I think where you and I both agree is I think 20 years down the road, it's going to be fantastic. How can it not be? You know, we have the technologies are so game changing. But from here until then, I'm starting to get really concerned about some of the shifts, some of the trends. So I'll just leave it open-ended there. What are you seeing? Do you agree with the sentiment that I have? Do you, you know, like, I'll just leave it there and sort of go from the top of your head if you like.
Sure. I definitely sympathize with the question. In fact, it's something I've been thinking about on and off and sometimes quite intensely for about 15 years now, with a number of retreats, weekend gatherings with economists and technologists, thinking about the future of work. What does it mean to have meaningful work in the future when all jobs can be done through automation, right? And sometimes in these thought experiments about the future, I find that it's much easier to look out 500 years than to look out 5 years. And the reason is, if you look out so ridiculously far to the future, the obvious point is you shift to what is inevitable endpoint for society versus where are we today and how do we get there from here? And I think it's a tale of opportunity and woe, meaning the farther in the future you look, the better the potential for a societal sort of norm of abundance and in cultural advancement. And there's so many positives one can imagine. And Peter Diamandis is sort of the clarion bell of what that future might look like.
He wrote a book called
Abundance, I recommend. The challenge is the transition from here to there. But let me at least start first painting the positive picture. In the distant future, robots will do everything that a human can do better than a human can do it. So all meaningless work, all tedious work, all things that are robotic, things that cause carpal tunnel syndrome, things that cause injuries, things that are dangerous, think mining up to, you know, physical labor that people only do because they need to pay the bills, right? And there's a lot of those kinds of jobs, sadly, all over the planet, right? Yep. a human will not be better than a robot at any of those. And then there's all the cognitive tasks. And this is the greater new challenge is that, you know, all the white collar jobs, all the, you know, of all things for AI to take on early, the idea of creative arts, you know, graphic yeah. arts, movies, what have you. It's like, whoa, we didn't imagine that happening first a few years ago. Yeah. Okay. That doesn't mean we will have an unpleasant society. This future world of abundance, everything will be inexpensive to manufacture, meaning all things will cost about $1 a pound to make, which is what it costs to grow a potato. So making a Ferrari, but for intellectual property and software charges and, you know, what have you, the physical yep. manufacturing costs you about $1 a pound for everything that we make. The human labor shouldn't be needed for anything that is unpleasant. We will still, you know, sew sweaters and do things out of nostalgia, and there'll be a huge price premium paid for things that embody the sort of handicraft of an individual making something like a sculpture. Yeah. And we'll still, just like we watch chess games today when they've been fully automated and the human chess player is still an amazing thing to watch. Just like, you know, we still watch running in the Olympics long after machines can run faster, if you will, on wheels. Yeah. You know, that'll still continue. But, and here will be a provocative statement. I think we can think about that distant future somewhat similar to much of humanity's past, where the indentured rich, if you will, didn't have to work, but yet found meaning in the arts and in science and in learning and what have you, because they had slaves or serfs. And in the future, the AIs and the robots will be those slaves and serfs, right? It won't be humans. Humans finally will not be cost effective, human slave labor, which is, you know, thank God, the long arc of history will hopefully bend towards not having any more human slave labor.
Yeah.
Jokingly aside, until the uprising, but we'll talk about that later.
Sure.
This might be great. Oh, by the way, Maslow's hierarchy of needs needs to be addressed. Food, shelter, clothing, and I would add education and healthcare. Education and healthcare are an information service. They should be free forever over a simple handheld device that eventually everyone will have. Everyone will have access to broadband via Starlink and other connections. So the world will be, the digital divide will finally be erased, right? Even the poorest of the poor will have access to online services so they can educate themselves like anyone else. You know, like kings couldn't do in the past, right? Okay. And again, if food, shelter, clothing is all dollar pound, this is like, what an incredible future. Economic surplus, what have you. Okay. There are a couple challenges. I do believe that future is inherently one of increased polarization of an inherently accelerating rich-poor gap. So I know you've spoken about UBI before, and I don't know of any other alternative that's been proposed for how to address this problem, which is at all fractal scales, meaning at the scale of nation states, companies, and individuals within companies, there will be a winner-take-all dynamic. Because as every information becomes an information business, it looks more like the information businesses we have today, where there's one or two companies that matter in any given geography, and then a bunch of has-beens, right? You know, also created. But like, how many browsers do you need? How many search engines do you need, right? And yes, there's disruption and upheaval, even in search. But in the long run, these things tend to polarize to incredible concentrations of economic gain to capital and to accomplishments in AI going forward. For example, we'll come to transportation, I'm sure, later, but like all that will matter in the future for a vehicle is its AI stack. Every other element of the car will be a commodity, just like it is for your phone, right? You know your next phone is going to look just like this. They're not going to look that different.
The iPhone 17 proved that. The iPhone 17 proved that a couple of days ago.
Exactly. Got a little thinner.
Yeah. Still got that huge camera bump, though. Yeah.
Exactly. So the challenge is, here's the problem, though. How do we get from here to there? And let's draw this in stark relief. Imagine we all agree that would be an amazing endpoint to end up with, and let's strive for that. How will any policymaker deal with the world when we're 10% there, 20% there, 30% there? At what point does it become so painful because you haven't put in place UBI, you haven't put in place anything that looks like the social constructs that preserve capitalism and democracy, two important tenets I believe in strongly. Like we have no better system of governance on earth. We have learned through the long, painful path of cultural evolution that that's how we should live and comport ourselves. But when 10% of the world at all fractal scales, 10% of countries are not part of the future, they're going to opt out, they're going to turn to who knows what, either a theocracy or some other belief system that rejects modernity, and they'll never catch up.
Yeah.
Same for companies that don't jump on the AI bandwagon or the software eats the world kind of mantra. Their products become relatively useless, just like the automotive sector will be for those cars that are not fully autonomous, just like rockets that are not fully reusable will be. Like it isn't like, oh, you become less competitive. It's you become irrelevant and you have a complete shift to the new entrant that you're seeing in automotive and aerospace. And that will be, think of that pattern now writ large for energy agriculture, food production, housing, construction, manufacturing, everything, right? Every business becomes an information business over time. And so this both polarization of winner take all dynamics, information industry sort of just the fundamental nature of the business. So how do we get any policymaker to look out more than 2 years, much less 4 years, and take into account the fact that we are on an inevitable trajectory that will induce a have and have not dynamic?
Yeah.
So to your core question, I think the sense of disenfranchisement occurs when there's inequality.
Yep.
And it can be addressed through a few means, like, you know, sometimes a social safety net. Like, you don't want people fearing for their, you know, basic food, shelter, clothing, healthcare. You know, that's a source of disruption to a societal fabric. Like, you don't have a stable society when you have that kind of incredible inequity.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I mean, this is literally like I spend an unhealthy amount of time thinking about this, honestly. And it's one of those, you know, I like to think of myself as a quite a positive person, especially since the birth of my child about a year ago. And I feel like that's been such a huge forcing function for me to always stay positive, to try to push through this. Like, I know, like, we're going to go through a period of it, at least it feels that way. But let me sort of, like, you know, the following Musk industry for me has been such an eye opener into that dynamic that you speak of, that during the age of artificial intelligence and the companies that do adopt artificial intelligence. So if you use Robotaxi as an example, right? Why is Robotaxi likely to be the most successful, self-driving stack in the world? It's because they figured out how to scale to 1.2 million units per year using vision only. And then that vision only system is what's going to allow them to just put Uber's equivalent fleet every 6 months in the United States.
One little sub point there that's really important is this brilliant stroke of basically enabling every vehicle for some time now to have the sensor stack that the future full self-driving cars will have. So they collect more driving data per week, and actually it's closer to per day, but let's say per week to be conservative, than Waymo has in its entire history.
Yeah.
Every single week. And that data flywheel that you use to train the AI, the same thing is going to happen when Robotaxi rolls out. It's going to be like an old compounding of the data set. Same thing will happen to Optimus, right?
Yeah.
As it's moving and interacting with the world, you're going to gain more data to make a better AI stack, to make a better robot, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so you just fast forward that into like the next 10, 20 years. And unless there are many more entrants that come in that are willing to take on that risk of innovation, that risk of, hey, like, you know, why hasn't legacy, you know, if you think about it, if it's such a no-brainer that this is going to be the end result, the question becomes, why hasn't legacy auto, let's say, adopted this? It's because they fundamentally cannot. They don't have the culture, they don't have the talent, they don't have the expertise. They're sort of beholden to an investor base that loves the buybacks and they love the dividends, and they don't want to risk that gravy train, let's say.
Yep.
So like, no, don't take the risk. That's crazy, you know? And then you have Elon sort of like, okay, all right, that's for me, I guess. I'll keep going into it, you know?
That is a fundamental observation. I think it's one of the most fascinating phenomenon that despite, it's almost like, a psychiatrist.
It's so obvious.
Like, you can see it in other industries. Like,
yeah,
almost like having a sixth sense. You can see dead companies, you know, and they just don't know they're dead yet. But you can't see it in yourself. And the general rule of thumb, I'd say, that has perhaps only one exception in the entire history of the world. Now, that's a preamble, right?
Yeah.
Is that no incumbent large business, who's, let's say, one of the top three in a major industry, has ever reinvented its core business. Now, so automotive is one example. Aerospace, even more dramatic, right, with SpaceX.
Yeah.
But then you might say, well, wait a second, wait, what about Hewlett Packard, Apple, Google? HP got into printers. They've done nothing in mainframe computers. Apple gets into music, and then the phone hasn't innovated in desktop or laptop computing for decades, right? There's nothing you point to. It matters on that front. Same with Google. Not the first to introduce a novel search modality. Has to, after having invented it, play catch up to OpenAI and Perplexity and others, right?
Yeah.
When they're forced to. Right, they never voluntarily lead this. And I say there's one exception, just to be complete. I think Netflix is the only example in the history of the world where someone has purposely reinvented their own core business, which is video distribution from DVD to online. But they premeditated that from day one, because I know they pitched us for their first round of funding. And they named the company Netflix because they knew one day they would have to make the switch. And when they did, they took like a 70% stock hit, and only a founder could have pulled that off. So it's like, it is such a rare anomaly. I used to be able to proudly say there's no exception, but now there is one. Automotive, right? So what has automotive been asleep at the switch on? Electric vehicle transition, of course, and the full autonomy stack. Like, they are in such denial. It is mind-blowing. Even this year, January of this year, I met with a board member of BMW who told me point blank that they have a better autonomous software stack than Tesla. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, and she was like going on and on about how it doesn't work. And so, of course, she hasn't been in the one because she's in Europe and she doesn't realize that she doesn't know what she doesn't know.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellion Air. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellion Air could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellion Air is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellion Air do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellion Air will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellion Air, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionair.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
It's insane.
It's like that. So what is that? Is that ego? Like, what is that? Is it like just an unwillingness of like, there has to be a blind spot, right? Or is it just, it's going to be too painful and you're trying to rationalize to yourself?
I think the organizational competence that is built up, like a company that is one of the top three in their industry has learned how to compete on this entire stack of things. Think about auto companies, the dealers that they sell through, how to make the most out of that. The internal combustion engine, which is a real beast to turn into something usable, and you know, how to make the most out of that. And then if it's a hybrid car, even more complex. All that competency, all the people in the organization that do that well become irrelevant in an EV autonomous switch, and they've atrophied their software skills. So this is true in automotive dramatically, but it's true in all the other industries as well. They have long since vertically integrated, not vertically integrated. They've done the opposite. They've outsourced to Delco and Continental and Bosch. You know, every little electronics module, when they used to be separate modules, like for analog brake system or this sort of ADAS, what have you, like everything was like a third party. And they thought that was great because they were taking basically advantage of the supplier networks to really drive home their cost economics around this just-in-time manufacturing.
It was like they MBA'd it.
Yeah. And now they can't do it internally. Like they just can't, like VW is spending ridiculous amounts of money. BMW is trying through joint ventures. All of them are trying. To either acquire or partner their way into competence, and they're really struggling.
Yeah. How common is that, like with let's say medium to large businesses where the core competencies and let's say the things that you shouldn't be outsourcing have been outsourced? Is that a prevalent thing or is that just exclusive?
It's sort of like the natural maturation of an industry where any company becomes big and powerful, they get too many people. So one of the sort of insidious and hard to quantify, but absolute negatives of a large organization is they just had too big a team. So for example, the CEO of Toyota-san met with Elon, J.B. Straubel and I just before, I'll timestamp it in a moment. This was a few years back, and he shared, the important point I want to share is that he mentioned his envy of Elon at Tesla, is that you have meetings with the people that matter. 100% of the meetings I have at Toyota have 100 people, meaning always, there's 100 people in the room, and the people with the most competency are most afraid to speak, and there's nothing I can do to change that. So like they're stuck with ridiculous team sizes that don't get things done, and that's one of the secret advantages of a small company. So you have this sclerotic bureaucracy of all the, you know, documented reasons why large organizations fail in every endeavor. And then interestingly, after he met with us, he went back and canceled all their EV programs. It's like they actually had EV programs. Like, what did we say that led you to believe that you should get rid of this and bet it all in hydrogen? Like, are you freaking, like, it was wild. So to your general point, there's a competency trap. Companies become good at what they do. And by definition, a disruption disrupts that. It's like, it wouldn't be disruptive. It's almost like a fait accompli that if something is disruptive enough to re-architect the basis of competition, to change the hardware product of a flip phone into a software and services thing where this is just a vessel for code. This is just a display device for obviously the software and services layers, which why you're buying into one ecosystem, be it Android or Apple. it's not the hardware, right? It totally changes the basis of competition. So no, it is a general rule of thumb that sort of innovator's dilemma is once you become big and successful at something, you almost never innovate except for when you do it outside your core business. So Apple has been innovative when they do something new. Google with Waymo is something new. It has nothing to do with search. It's like as far removed from Google's obvious core competency that you could imagine. Yeah. That's where big companies can innovate. And they do, just not in their core business.
So what's interesting about that is you know, given the arc of AI and how it's going to just fundamentally transform and disrupt how we do work on so many different in so many different ways, are large businesses at an all-time risk of being replaced by a wave of brand new businesses that come through that have adopted the super fast capabilities and the super smart capabilities of AI? You know, based on, you know, very small companies, 5-6 people, whatever it is. And then, okay, let's just start with AI. We just know exactly what we need to do. And then all these big businesses are going to be too slow, too late, too much ego, too much empire building. You know, do you see that as a trend for the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. I think Elon once called it a supersonic tsunami, which I think is a good world to imagine, the gales of change and the winds of disruption. Here's an interesting context. A statement like what you just made, as profoundly new and different as it sounds, in a way describes all of the past as well.
Sure.
We've been living on a uninterrupted exponential, I would argue, for over 130 years in technology, which is this version of Moore's Law I like to plot, which is, you know, a logarithmic scale in a slightly upticking straight line is like an exponential. Over 130 years of what really matters in Moore's Law, which is how much compute can a dollar buy. And so it feels like perpetual future shock. It's just that the time frames of these disruptions are shrinking.
Compressed.
So that, you know, what used to be an intergenerational thing, like, hey, the kids are doing something different than their parents. Like in ancient times, right, a baker had baker kids, a shoemaker had shoemaker kids. It's like these were like industries that were passed down like apprenticeships over hundreds of years. And then changes occurred intergenerationally. Then they occurred, you know, more like, you know, like different cohorts, if you will. We call them like Gen Zs and millennials and all this kind of stuff. And then it was more like, oh, which graduating year were you from the AI program? Or like, yeah. Completely irrelevant things, right? It's like now it's you can't even get through a 4-year degree in a technical field without it feeling obsolete by the time you've finished. So, So my point is just this perpetual future shock is a fundamental element, I think, of accelerating change in society, in technology, and in business. And technology is driving. I think the fundamental big arc over time is that the pace of progress is perpetually accelerating. And one of the reasons is quite simple, at a very high level of abstraction, is that every idea itself is a recombination of prior ideas. Like it's almost never the case that someone has a fundamentally breakthrough idea that has no precedent or predecessor upon which it built. So standing on the shoulders of giants, if you will. Yeah. So if you think of a simple mental model, there's N ideas in the world. They used to be fractionated, geography, you know, guns, germs, and steel. There used to be eras when some countries got ahead of others because they had ideas that the others didn't have. Cultural advance may be one of the few areas where that still persists, but I digress. Then we have the internet and ideas are spreading like never before on the planet. People can connect and form businesses like never before. You can find, you know, a cohort of like-minded individuals or people who have a passion about something. You had academic disciplines that were formally segregating idea spaces. And then you have, you know, these really breakthrough ideas would span across those interstices. And so, to make a long story short, I think both the internet has broken down those barriers and AI as a translation tool can help us see the patterns from different sciences that were formerly discrete, like information theory here and genetic engineering there and who knows what from pick a field of study. A lot of the ideas can now cross-pollinate like never before. I mean, that's going to be the creativity boom of AI. But this long-winded sort of preamble is all to say the number of possible idea pairings, pick any 2, 3, 4 ideas and recombine them in new ways, it grows as 2^n power. So you have N ideas, the 2^n, it's called Reed's Law, subgroupings you can make. So you have this perpetual combinatorial explosion of ideas that are formed of other ideas, and that's growing as 2^n power over time. So it's just hyperbolic.
Wow.
And we humans, and the rate at which we communicate is the only thing that has been limiting that. Like how long does it take for two people from disparate fields to come together, realize a new idea, and execute on it? I think that's going to go into overdrive with AI.
Yeah, right? You know what's also really interesting there too, and I think maybe this is, I mean, it's not flying under the radar, but I mean, I guess if you think about the impact of Starlink, you know, so, but like Starlink in places where they never had internet, like broadband.
Yeah. And like 3 billion people.
It's like almost half the world. And then all of a sudden they're going to get internet and AI.
That's right.
And what is that going to do?
Education, the courses from MIT are free. Realize these 3 billion people are not part of the global economy today.
Yeah.
In any meaningful way. They buy a little bit of product from Unilever and Procter & Gamble, you know, and other food suppliers that are generally local. They're subsistence farmers in many cases. They're off the grid in every sense of the word. They are just little islands of humanity, little pockets of intelligence that are uncoupled from the economy. They will become fully coupled. They're just as smart as we are. They're just as capable as they are. They care about their kids just as much as we do. And they're going to become part of that entrepreneurial pool all within the next 5 years or so. That's just unforecastable.
It's crazy.
Like, that's going to be like a boom to progress in the positivity side, as like never before.
Yeah. Right? And what's interesting about that too is like they're not encumbered by that innovator's dilemma either, right? So they're almost starting exactly right. So like renewable energy sources where you have decentralized energy generation and storage that like powers your entire civilization, and then you know once you lay down the roads, just stick self-driving cars in there. Why not? Just put the robotaxi in there, and all of a sudden, in 10, 20 years time, you're going to have places in these sort of that 3 billion person population. It's kind of like very analogous to like, you know, how China industrialized and they sort of skipped the landline, they went straight to the cell phone. It's Bingo. Like these places are going
technology. Yep.
Right. Yeah.
They can be like distributed off grid solar. They don't have to have the utility coming to their home. They don't have to have fiber coming to their home. They can go direct to satellite. It's
unbelievable.
Also, by the way, through the next generation of Starlink connectivity, the phone itself is going to have a decent connection to the, you know, stations in the sky, wherever you may be. You're not even going to need custom hardware on the ground. Yeah. It's just kind of amazing.
That's crazy, man. So thinking through that, that's obviously going to happen at some point. Like it's, you know, it's going to be hard to pinpoint 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, but
the penetration rate takes time, just physical hookups and all that. Yep.
Of course. Yeah. Now I think what's interesting about that is with the advent of our ability to get much better at manufacturing, you know, everything is going to improve with AI, both in the physical and digital world. How do you see the sort of like the ability to spring up a civilization in places that would have previously been, you know, like we wouldn't have thought about it. So like, you know, terraforming the desert as an example, or making these giant domes in the Arctic, or, you know, like just it's a lot easier to build a city or a town in the middle of the Rocky Mountains, right? Like these prime real estate areas that traditionally people don't really move to because the infrastructure is not there. One would think that was right. So it's like, are we closer to doing a Mars beta on Earth that's going to create a lot of habitable places that weren't previously habitable? And how much of that is going to be the work we're going to need to do on Mars? Right. So how do you think through that?
It's interesting. I don't have a well thought out answer to that question, but it is intriguing. And that thought experiment has certainly occurred to me a few times, which is, wait a second, like even in the early days of the internet, you know, does this work from home phenomenon mean that you can have, you know, a boom in, you know, people choosing to live in beautiful places that they want to live in, as opposed to feeling, you know, obliged to be within some horrible commute within, you know, some distance, let's say in the Bay Area here, or San Francisco or Silicon Valley. There are some countervailing forces. So first off, I do believe, of course, you know, we're going to try to pioneer how we live on Mars. And that's a whole different conversation we can have in a moment. But on Earth, there are some advantages to cities. So let me just mention an interesting countervailing trend is that urbanization has been going up, crossing the 50% mark, meaning it wasn't until recently that the majority of humans lived in a city. And it seems inexorable that's increasing, especially if you include the Chinese population in that. There are some inherent advantages of a city. The Santa Fe Institute director has written an interesting book on this called Scale. And he makes some interesting points about how all kinds of things we might take for granted, like how much does it cost to insulate and heat a building for winter per person? You know, how much water use, how much land resource use, you name it, anything that matters as, you know, as a consumable is more efficient than a city per capita, per person. But interestingly, the innovativeness, the rate at which people invent new things is higher per capita in a city. You know, pause for that moment. We're not saying just there's more people there for more ideas. We're saying the average person is more innovative. And the hypothesis is that this is sort of like the physical common ground. So this may change with more internet connectivity and work from home, because all this data is, you know, backward looking, of course. But where people got together in the salons of the mind, the cafes, the opportunistic connections between people, if we're all, in a sense, mimetic messengers, we are the vessels through which good ideas get carried around in our little cortex and then shared with others. And if we think of it almost like the mimetic, not in the online joke sense, in the, you know, old, you know, Dawkins and others who've written about, and Susan Blackmore, I think, first came up with the term, this idea that we're just vessels for ideas, that both that come to our explosion ideas. It's a very interesting framework to think about what's the point of humanity, what is culture, what is, you know, all these big ideas. But back to cities, you're less lonely, you have more opportunities for social interaction and opportunistic interplay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're, imagine an extreme, you're the hermit, but you have a good online broadband. You know, are you as happy? Are you as isolated? And we can look at the COVID example as perhaps, you know, perhaps not so much, right? This something about physical proximity promoting, you know, just happiness, right? So, and you think about all the other things, you know, schooling systems, and do you want socialization of your kids at school? The transmission lines, well, okay, are you going to be fully off grid? You know, and then you might think, well, is it a microgrid? Is it a subscale? So some of these, you know, if you will, just pushing out to the hinterlands, I think will happen for some clusters and could happen like it couldn't as easily before, but I don't think it will, in retrospect, looking back, let's say 5 years in the future, be like, oh yeah, that was the mega trend that counterbalanced urbanization.
Yeah.
Right? So anything in China coming from the fields where people don't want to work the fields and agrarian society flocking to the cities, that trend is still underway in China.
Gotcha. Yeah. So actually that makes a lot of sense. So I think, you know, and I can speak from experience too. Like I've done both. I've done the in-person, I've done the work from home. I'm doing, you know, this entrepreneurial thing, and it's hard to replicate. And I don't know if you share this thought too, but I'm most inspired when I'm with other people. And I don't know, and I don't know what it is. It's like, it's just being able to see someone's body language when you share something profound, and then you have that connection, and then you're like, fuck yeah, let's go. Excuse my French. Like just super fired up. I feel like that's very difficult to replicate in any form, like over the screen. I don't know, maybe VR or Neuralink somehow can, you know, do that for us in the next 20 years or whatever. But I feel like
I wouldn't bet on that. I wouldn't bet on VR. Okay. That's my dystopian view of the future. Like, shit, I hope we don't go that way.
Yeah. So I guess a very good outcome from this would be, it would be optimizing our ability to be close to each other when we want to or need to be close to each other. I guess that's what a good future would look like, right? It's like, hey, I want to get to this place right now. I need to work with other people, or I want to spend time with somebody. It's like, okay, now it's almost like how close can we get to a teleport button where we can go from not wanting to be around people to being around people? And I guess that's the optimization of the future.
I think it's deeply rooted in our biology to seek this. It's both the tribal instinct to say, are you an in-group or out-group? The incredible anxiety people feel when they're canceled. Why would that be? It's because you've been rejected by the tribe. Back in olden days, it's kind of astounding that society considered it as bad as the death penalty to be banished. Yeah. Think about how many people that did like whatever the worst crime is, you know, like you assassinated somebody or whatever. It's like, you weren't killed, which would be like the obvious thing. You were just banished. And like,
that was almost worse. It's almost worse, right? Because you're like, it's just terror. You're just by yourself. Mm-hmm. It's just isolation is the worst. You know, that's one of the main things is one of the things about the death penalty is like, well, the death penalty is less cruel than, you know, isolation. It's like sticking somebody in a jail cell and letting them be there by themselves. It's crazy.
The worst punishment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
No. Sure. You are. Yeah. I think, you know, we saw this with COVID, with the spike of adolescent, you know, drinking, mood disorders, depression, against a backdrop of steady increase, almost tripling since, you know, in the last 20 years, and then, you know, went through the roof during COVID isolation. I think we've run the natural experiment, meaning we didn't want to run that experiment. We did, and it was very unpleasant outcomes. I think the sense of neighborliness, of connectedness, of feeling part of the community is been somewhat fractured. And I think we're suffering that in a number of ways. Do we feel unified as a people, or do we feel fractious as never before?
Yeah, I think there's been a trend since COVID where there's an increasing and maybe this, maybe I'm just too online, we'll see. But there's an increasing gap between how the real world feels and what online feels. Online, at least for me, maybe I'm exposing my algorithm here, but where my head is at, you know, it is funny. Like ever since I had a kid, man, it's like I've just been in this mode of like what can I do to make the world better for my kid? Like, and then it's been a lot of like exploration of like, okay, so if I need to understand what the baseline is, what does baseline world look like? And the more I'm peeling back the layers, it feels like I'm like, boy, like there's a lot of stuff we got to fix, man. Like but on the positive side, that's how humans progress. That's how civilizations get better.
By the way, you know, I was reminded of what you just said. Like, so we shouldn't just take that for granted in a way. I mean, that is essential to the driving force many people have to make the world a better place. Why does Steve Jobs say, let's change the world for the better? What is this motivation? And my partner, Mariana here, co-founder of my firm, recently had her first child. And I mean, like, it just, she said almost the exact same words. Like, oh my God, I found a newfound desire and imperative to think about the world we're building for her, right? For her daughter. Yeah. And, you know, I felt that I have five kids and I absolutely can feel it. You feel like this enormous diversification to life's purpose, if not the primary version, you know, reason for life's purpose, becomes apparent to you in a way that was invisible before.
Yeah.
And with declining birth rates globally and a postponement of child, you know, experience for many people, there's a pocket, if you will, of those who may not be so enfranchised with the future. And, you know, I think it would be great if the leaders of our nation and of, you know, policymakers were in that camp, that were like younger themselves and able and willing to make a better future for everyone that follows, right? That's I think for humanity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I do want, I mean, Elon talks about the sort of, he's been the first, from my standpoint, the first prominent figure that has been beating the drum on this birth rate thing, right? And I think at surface level, it's like, people are like, oh, you know, the number go down, make number go up, right? But then if you really think about it, it's like having children is the ultimate investment into the future.
Sure.
Like the ultimate. Like you're basically saying, I want the future to be better and I know the future is going to be better and I want to bring somebody into the world that I can enjoy that future with and put it in a place so that that person can, that human that I've created can also make the future even better for their children and their grandchildren. And I think that's the underlying trend that we're losing out on. It's that forcing function to make the future better in a sense, you know? And it's like, and I really do wonder if more people, and this is part of the reason why I also like, I try to keep a positive outlook and I try to do this podcast and all that stuff is like, and that's why I love technology so much, because technology is such a forcing function for positive outcomes for humanity. You know, like medicine, freaking art, like the AC in your house, you know, like how many people die from just heat around the world, you know, not having AC and just having running water and all these things. Like these are all technology. It, like the reason why we've had an exploding population in the last few hundreds of years and thousands of years, I guess it's like the development of technology has made it easier to be alive.
And that's it's true. I think technology is synonymous with progress.
Yeah,
they are one and the same, especially if some people define technology to include the things that we've invented in terms of social constructs. So things like, you know, a form of government that we invent that we didn't have before. You can think of it as a technology. It's a slight expansion of what some may have a narrower definition, but that is progress. And in the long ago history, people didn't notice it. It didn't happen much over the course of an entire generation. Where, you know, let's say the farming efficiency that someone was dependent on in an agrarian society didn't change dramatically. If anything, progress was lost against the cycle of weather. Did we have a drought this year or not? Did we have a flood this year or not? That was like the life of most of humanity throughout most of history, where maybe a bearded prophet, someone looking much like yourself, but a little warmer, would say, oh my God, winter is coming, you know? And that would be like really the thing that for survival that you would need to remember is that every once in a while, there's like this really horrible thing. Let's store some grain to make it have winters. Like that was basically humanity. And now the arc of exponential progress has finally risen above the cyclicality. Right. So she'll say, like, for example, Moore's Law is like, you know, the Great Depression, World War I, World War II, all of these major events to the economy didn't change the rate at which technology progressed as measured.
Yeah.
that version of Moore's Law, that abstraction of it. And so it keeps reminding me that, you know, we're no less inventive in economic cycles. We're no less productive. It's an entirely orthogonal dynamo of value generation with, you know, fits and starts of, you know, human dramas, companies coming and going, economic policies that are self-detrimental, you know, whether it's, you know, one stupid idea after another the government's come up with to limit progress. Nevertheless, the technologists just keep going.
yeah, for sure. Okay, so let me ask you this question. So what's the vibe like with the builders right now? Because it does feel like there's, my circles are going to be extremely different from yours, but like I get a sense that, you know, people are really inspired to build stuff right now. Like they're really looking to, like they are actually, like it's all hands on deck. We're going to go. Like, do you feel the same? Like, would you
Absolutely.
Agree with us?
And like I've never felt before. So I do mention, hey, I think we've always had exponential change and it just keeps going at it. But here's the thing that I think is fundamentally new is the scope of entrepreneurial ambition. The number of industries, the number of sectors that were thought to be intractable or beyond repair or got governments or NGOs or somehow world government coming together, climate change, you name it, right? You know, agricultural productivity, getting off of bad pesticides, nuclear, you know, fusion, colonizing Mars. You know, pause for a moment and think back just 20 years before, let's say, any of Elon's companies were highly visible, you know, the modern ones. These would have been crazy thoughts that a private startup could take on any things I just mentioned, from nuclear fusion to Mars colonization. These were the domains of moonshot initiatives of governments. So not just a government scale activity, but among the biggest government scale activities ever undertaken. And now it seems obvious. These new entrants, companies that didn't exist 30 years ago, are leading all of the charges in all the areas that matter. And you can't point to anything a government has done that mattered when it comes to progress. You have governments that have slowed progress. You have governments that worked on equity and trying to, you know, avert harms. But none of them has said, oh, I solved the climate problem, or I got us off gasoline, or I figured out nuclear energy. Like, no, they haven't made any progress in the last 30 years on anything. Yeah. The technologists have all around us. And back to your point about the vibe or the zeitgeist or the sentiment is, oh, it's time to build. It's time to reindustrialize. This spans everything from mining to, of course, software. It's going to transform every industry. And I believe Elon's companies, specifically SpaceX and Tesla, have a large role to play in catalyzing the dreamers to dream, the investors to believe in it, and all up and down the stack, from early stage venture capitalists to public market buyers. You have billions of dollars of capital flowing into AI, into SpaceX, into Tesla in ways that were unfathomable last, 30 years ago. Like by the way, a $100 million round of financing in the 90s was insanely huge. When DST did that in Facebook, it was like, what? They invested $100 million in a late stage company? Like, not even a startup, right? A late stage company. Because prior to that, no one had invested $100 million in anything. Wow. You know, in aggregate, Webvan had raised over $100 million, but it took SoftBank many rounds of funding. And like, those were insane numbers. Nobody could envision $1 billion being invested in anything ever.
Wow.
And now it's a seed round for Amira's company.
I would like to announce that I'm starting a Series A right now. Okay.
Series A, a seed round, a multi-billion-dollar seed round. Like, what in the world? Man.
So, okay. So it's so fascinating hearing you say that, you know, because, you know, I felt this too. I mean, there's a reason why Elon has the following he has. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his. You know, I worked at his company. Like, I've been following him since 2012. He's always had this magnetic energy around him, around like this. What's possible is way bigger than you think, and I'm going to prove it to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's why he has the sort of like the cohort of people that really admire him, follow him, hate him, right? There's just a lot of things. Yeah, they're jealous, exactly. And so it's very interesting to hear you say that he's sort of been a singular person in inspiring almost like a generation or a group of people to actually be willing to take risks and go in and actually build things. Because he's okay. So now there's going to be a compounding effect.
I'm going to add an emphatic exclamation point to what you said. Yeah. I don't think it is possible to overstate his contribution to humanity.
Really?
I've never heard a statement from anyone that says, oh, that overstates it. I believe he's the greatest hit of the American dream writ large, like bar none. Immigrant comes to South Africa, changes every industry that he looks at with great success for the better. Gets us on a, you know, post-gasoline trajectory like never before. Gets us on an autonomous driving trajectory like no one else could. You know, we'll soon make humanity a multi-planetary species, which will go down in the long, like multi-thousand year history of humanity as one of the major accomplishments of humanity.
Saves free speech in the West.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Well, that's important too. Yeah. Like, and all this is just getting started.
Holy shit. Yeah. I mean, it really is, you know, and it's easy to lose sight of that. Like, you know, somebody like myself, like I follow his trajectory. Like a lot of the things we cover on this channel is Musk industry, you know? And it's like, sometimes it's like, you know, in my head, I'm like just used to seeing that. Like I'm used to seeing Elon saying major problem, we're going to fix it. And then I'm like, oh, of course he's going to fix it. Obviously he's going to be late and he's going to be very like way too ambitious on the timelines. But that's part of his process. It's like he's trying to bring the future forward faster, right? Inspiring people, inspiring his staff to go as fast as they can to make stuff happen. So that's really, really, that's just awesome to hear, honestly. And I think the compounding effect of that, you know, like the one thesis I had coming out of Tesla when I left the company in 21 was I was surrounded by so many talented people. I mean, it was unbelievable. Like just you know, I'd be very fortunate to be around really smart people. Before Tesla, I was at a pet food distributor company, biggest one in the United States. I learned so much from that executive group. I'm like, man, these people are smart. Then I went to Tesla. I'm like, holy shit. Whoa. My God. And then my thesis was what happens when this talent starts propagating the world? Like what happens when these guys and girls start doing their own thing, you know, and all the people that are inspired by what Elon is doing and his businesses, what happens when they start doing their own thing? Right. And it seems like now those guys and gals are starting to build. They're starting they're starting to go all in on their stuff. You know?
Yeah, someone should trace the whole family tree of kind of like they did back in the day from Fairchild and, you know, Intel and other companies coming from the early days of the semiconductor industry. Then you have the PayPal mafia, which is, you know, all the people that were in that concentration of incredible talent, like all of the companies they started. It's astounding. Right? That one's been traced. Yeah. Then you have now new generations of SpaceX and Tesla alum that are doing all kinds of things. Like, for example, Commonwealth Fusion, I think, has more people from SpaceX than any other place. And it's like that talent pool and that... Yeah. Wanting that, like people will describe these work experiences as the toughest of their life, yet the most rewarding. Right. Yeah. And it used to be the same with Steve Jobs, by the way. I worked briefly at Apple and Next. And I got to tell you, it was the same sentiment there for folks who work directly with Steve Jobs, not the large bureaucracy that Apple's become.
Sure.
And it really is invigorating for the best and the brightest. Like you want to work with people who are capable, who are changing the world for the better, who have, by the way, that mission. By the way, every one of Elon's companies, you notice, he has a bold mission that every employee can state, every customer, every partner, and it's something you aspire to. And then he chains back to the present, and therefore we have to do X, Y, Z, you know, and actually iterate with customers and be pragmatic. Yes, but we all know it. And that has a fascinating impact as you scale an organization, let's say the Tesla size today, which is you can orient a organization around that prioritization more easily than you can something kind of indirect, like maximize shareholder value. Like who the hell cares about that? Or should they say, I'm here to maximize shareholder value. And then they can debate. Almost certainly what will maximize it this month or this quarter is in opposition to what will maximize it over 10 years.
Yeah.
And therefore you're gonna have all kinds of differing opinions on what's a priority and what's not. Whereas it's SpaceX and Tesla. I can tell you, being on the board of both companies, it is really clear. There's this resonance to the activity of people that says, let's get this vehicle out so that we can get the next vehicle out, because that's the march of the master plan. And we all get it to the goal of no longer burning oil and gas. Like, wouldn't that be amazing?
100%. It's like everyone's bought in. And I can speak to that very directly. Just I was on the service distribution side. I wasn't even in the manufacturing side. And that culture was there. Like everybody was like, we need to make sure everyone's cars are fixed and on the road so that they're happy with owning a Tesla, so they can tell their friends to go buy a Tesla, because the more Teslas and EVs are on the road, the better it's going to be for the climate long term. And the better it's going to be for, you know, like one of the things that always gets sort of missed in this whole discussion, it's also great for national security, you guys. Like it's like moving all the supply chains here to the States.
Oh,
it's giant.
We were spending like an insane amount of money per day, multiple billions per day, to nations that want to take us down when we were more dependent on oil and gas. Yeah. The supply chain interruption risk. You see that in Europe now. Oh my God, Russian gas. Like this, it is so obviously better for a nation to not emit carbon burning fossil fuels geopolitically. Yeah. And like, the sooner we can get like over ourselves and rapidly ramp back up nuclear, which, God, if we'd only done that 60 years ago and never gotten the coal. I mean, think about that, by the way, the alternate history. If the early environmental movement hadn't embraced nuclear energy in a really ignorant way, something to be scared of because of, well, there's a number of reasons why. I'm reading this book, Rad Future, that goes into a bunch of this. But like, imagine instead we're like, no, let's look at the data. It's the safest, cleanest sort of energy we could do. If we just hadn't switched to coal from nuclear, the majority of greenhouse gases in the air today caused by humanity would not be there.
Wow.
Literally, there would be no discussion about global warming. There would be no worry about greenhouse gases. Over half of it is because of that singular decision to move away from nuclear and embrace coal instead. Right. And so don't get me started.
That's crazy.
We can, you know, and we just need to do it.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. I think, you know, so let me shift to Mars a little bit here. So we're approaching an hour. Are you still okay on time, Steve?
Yeah.
So sort of on the topic of Elon, but adjacent to sort of like the long term here. So to get Mars started, that's an extremely ambitious goal. And obviously, so we have to get there, obviously, number one. the most underrated thing of all time. Oh, Mars is going to be hard. Okay. But there's going to be a lot of industry that has to be created from scratch on Mars.
While we're talking, I'll just, I've been fondling a piece of the moon, but this is actually a rock from Mars. In fact, my entire office is a space museum of Apollo artifacts hanging from the ceiling and everything. And on my desk is a huge pile of meteorites. So this is what was at a time the second largest Mars rock on Earth. It came as a meteorite. But this is what one day will be a commodity, you know.
Wow. How cool is that? Holy shit. That's so dope. Yeah, man. There's going to be so much industry that has to be created on Mars that is almost has to be custom made for Mars. And I wonder how many of those things could be trialed on Earth and it be gigantic industries on Earth. So let me go through some examples here. Electric vehicles seem like the perfect way to get around on Mars and not in internal combustion.
Not gonna drive. And we're not gonna have oil. Like there isn't like the, oh, let's pump and get oil. It probably doesn't exist on Mars.
Exactly. Yeah. You got, so Starship and reusable rockets, those are gonna be extremely important to go to Mars, but it's also gonna be great for moving freight or people anywhere in the world within 90 minutes.
Alternate meat manufacturing. We're not gonna grow cows or pigs on Mars. And even though that pisses off, I'm a meat eater, right? So like, it's not meant to be like, oh, we're gonna have some vegan policy. It's like, no, that is insane to recreate the ecosystem required and the inefficiencies in land, water, and energy use to have that. But you can do cellular ag. You can basically do what Upside Foods does, which is grow the meat without the animal, something that is an inevitable future, by the way. We'll have to do that on Earth too. And that's been one of our hypotheses around alternative protein and alternative meat manufacturing with an eye towards Mars in the future, but do it on Earth now because we have to, right?
Exactly. So, and I wonder, like, is that a feasible investing strategy even? Like, if I'm putting on like my investing hat, it's like, okay, what are the things that we're going to have to need on Mars to get to self-sustaining that would be hugely beneficial on Earth? Right.
And I think it is a good thought experiment. I think there obviously be some filters around some versus others. So for example, there's been a long history of spin-off technologies and what have you. So I think on one hand, yes to everything in the sense that it would be better if there's a terrestrial business use case to start ramping up production and what have you with an eye towards Mars. But the caveats are a lot of the things that you want to do on Mars, you want to use the local resources. In the long run, you want to use 100% local resources. So in situ manufacturing, as they say. So for example, buildings, structures, caves, greenhouses, you name it. You would ideally want to think about, okay, what do I have on Mars that I can use to build this stuff versus shipping all the raw materials? Not only because it's more expensive to ship raw materials, but ultimately from a sustainability point of view, it's got to be locally sourced. That may or may not limit what you do. So the atmosphere is different there. It doesn't have nitrogen the way we do here. It's got a lot of CO2 to work with, which is great. A lot of carbon, unlike the moon, which is very low in carbon. Mars has lots of carbon. So you've got things. This is, by the way, why SpaceX shifted from kerosene fuel on the Falcon 9 to methane on Starship. It's to get back from Mars. It's much easier to make methane on Mars to refuel and oxygen, your two things you need for your rocket, than it is to make kerosene, because you're not going to drill again and find oil like we have on Earth. So you have to make kerosene from very simple molecules, much more energetically complex. Why not just make CH4? Methane is just a very small, simple molecule. And oh, by the way, it's abundant in the United States, and it's abundantly easily made with the Sabatier process on Mars. Okay. So with that thinking, there's certain things where I'm not sure I would get into, let's say, housing, to say, hey, let's build cheap housing on Earth because you use the same structures on Mars. There's a variety of reasons having to do with the atmosphere, the temperature and radiation exposure, that your structures will look different, and you want to use local materials. But food manufacturing within greenhouses, absolutely. Sort of indoor ag, if you will, as well as just alternative protein sources, robotics. Like, so it's sort of obvious now, but think even 5-10 years ago, it wasn't so obvious as it's just like obvious that the landing parties on Mars will be humanoid robots, right?
Yeah.
Humanoid,
yeah.
Not rolled, you know, for their adaptive nature. There's a reason why the Optimus is the perfect landing party, and will be there to build the structures, for example, to refuel the spacecraft to get home. You're not going to send a human on the very first mission because they can't get back. You need right. to send robots to build the refueling station to refuel the starships so that you can have round trips. It's sort of obvious. I do think also, just one last meta point, is that when you think about space and Mars in particular, but space in general, it's the ultimate sustainability challenge, right? If you're in literally outer space, in the vacuum of space, you are trying to recycle everything, every human waste product, every element of energy. This was true in the Apollo program, which, you know, I have around me to remind me all the incredible efforts they went to have energy, power, battery, you know, what have you, for these missions. Fuel cells were essential to pull it off, for example. And that's sort of an interesting challenge, because if you solve that problem for the most extreme environment, well, it's going to be a better product on Earth as well, right? So it's a better car, for example. All of the cars on the moon, you know, there's three of them, are electric vehicles. They were made by GM. In fact, General Motors' first electric vehicles are sitting on the moon. They couldn't destroy them like they did the EV1, so they're still up there.
Too far away.
There's probably more, you know, lunar rover GM car EV1s. You know, everything from food, energy, you know, you name it. It's going to make for more sustainable technology stack on Earth if you think about Mars as a design goal.
Got it. So that's super helpful. The human to robot point is a very interesting one, because I agree with you. Once it became obvious that the first bipedal things on Earth would be human or robots, it's like, okay, well, of course, obviously, duh. It didn't become obvious until it became obvious that the technology is actually here for us to build.
A reasonable person would, in fact, some roboticists still say,
and it's all the brain, oh my God, too, right?
We're nowhere near ready.
It's the brain. It's not, exactly.
Bingo. Exactly. Just like autonomous cars were perceived to be like, there was a time when people actually argued that autonomous driving was like the Turing test. Like, you have super intelligence if you could drive a car, because driving a car involves all of the perceptual decision-making, what have you, aspects that, like, you really need to be human to do. Like, obviously not. Same for a humanoid robot, right? There's been a difficulty to train with the data sets we have, but that's the data flywheel we were talking about earlier. The more robots you have, the more data you'll have. Whoever's an early mover is going to really have an advantage there. You know, actuators, like, so once again, Elon's had to vertically integrate, because there was no off-the-shelf electric motor that met the precision needs. Just like the Starlink satellites and the Tesla cars, you can't just buy off-the-shelf automotive or space-grade components and hit the design goal that you're trying to hit, right? So same with the robots. He's once again opening humanity's eyes that, you know, we could do something decades sooner than others might have thought.
For sure. And so along that thread, it feels, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, it feels to me that the human or robot is actually going to come a lot faster than people expect. And the reason why, here's my thesis. So if this is a physical body, and we are solving the intelligence piece, it's still going to take a long time for a general purpose human or robot that can do all, let's say, 80% of human tasks. It's going to take a long time, but the repetitive pickup, picking up and putting down is such a huge part of, like, labor, like physical paid labor around the world. Right. And then you think about the ability to separate man and machine. Right. So if we draw a parallel to the robotaxi as an example, the robotaxi from a regulatory perspective has a lot of scrutiny for a reason. It's because we drive road missiles and we go, you know, we go like this at 65 miles an hour. And like, there's a white line that separates us. Right. Or a yellow line, like that's It's legitimately one of the craziest thought experiments I've ever gone through. Because now every time I see a, especially with a child in the car, yeah. I'm like, holy shit.
Trust me, yeah. Exactly. Their phones and distracted. Or,
It's insane. But with a human or robot, you can create, you can, even with existing factories or warehouses as an example, if you are really concerned about the safety aspect of the robot, you can create the separation of man and machine. So you can give a percentage of the building to the human or robot and then let them do that repetitive, let's say low lift task. And it doesn't feel like we're that far away from that.
No, exactly. Right. And that's where you get started. That's where you get the data flywheel going rather than imagining in grandma's home, which will eventually be in an industrial setting. There are all kinds of unpleasant jobs that the humanoid robot can do. And the interesting and obvious point is if a human's able to do it, the humanoid robot can too. In other words, you set the design spec to be roughly the same lifting capacity. And because they can lean back, they can balance themselves the way, by the way, a wheeled robot cannot. So one of the advantages of humanoids over wheeled robots is if you want to lift something and not topple over, there's no real easy way to do it physics-wise on a wheeled robot, unless you have a really wide base, heavy base, right? So if you want something that could, for example, maneuver everywhere that the Americans with Disabilities Act allows a wheelchair to go. So in most workplaces, offices, what have you, if you have access to wheelchairs, in theory, a wheeled robot should be able to follow the same routes. And so the thought experiment is why put legs on it, right? Which doubles the number of motors and all this. But the point is lifting objects, right? So once you go to the, once you bite the bullet and go full humanoid in form, you have a hard argument saying, oh, it couldn't do that job. Point to any job a human's doing. It's like, well, it could, right? And by the way, I invested in this thesis 13 years ago. I was actually the first customer of a humanoid robot from a company called Rethink Robotics that Rodney Brooks had done. We were investors there. And I literally bought the very first unit. It was kind of like having the first Apple II, just to play around in our lobby. And it was a humanoid robot, torso, two arms and a head, but no legs. And it just sat there. But it could do anything a human could do in theory. And you programmed it by just moving the arms. And it was safer on humans. In other words, it had the sensors on every appendage segment. So it could, you know, work in and among people. But the investment thesis was, well, shit, there's people sitting in China all over the place doing precision piecework all the time. And so why don't we just first go with those sitting jobs? Anyone who's sitting and doing something at a desk that's mechanical at an assembly line or what have you, just like, automate all that. And so you could use that same thought experiment now. Once you're on a bipedal, you could do anything. And I think you were right in your statement. It will be easier to get the safety element of the software stack buttoned down in a work environment than a home environment. Because they are heavy. You don't want them to topple. And so you want to get that software stack really down, just like the car, right? We're now learning we can trust the car, you know, to drive us. But it's a huge, heavy machine that is, like you said, like a missile. Like, we should now realize it's safer to trust the software stack than, let's say, your parents.
Right.
My mom, in theory, is allowed to drive. That would be terrifying, right?
Yeah.
So it'll soon be better than teen drivers, it'll be better than all drivers soon. And same with the humanoid robots. It may start being scary, like, wow, what if it falls over? It's heavy. It could fall downstairs. And there were some early, by the way, robotics forays years ago, decades ago, where they did fall downstairs. And they're like, oh, God, that's scary at a hospital, let's say. And hospital robotics was put back by like a decade because they're like, well, that could be dangerous. Let's not do that. So in a long-winded way, I think you get the data flywheel going of, you know, actually having feedback loops on what's going on in the physical world. What are all the impediments and opportunities that present themselves? And how do you get the control loops to all be, you know, effective in industrial settings? And then by the time they get into the home, you know, they're bulletproof.
Yeah, for sure. And then like one of the things I'm thinking through too is like once that flywheel is proved out in the controlled environment and we know safety is going to be good, what's stopping like it's not even like work or home. It's also like what's stopping Dubai in like 5-10 years time from just, or like whatever developed city around the world that has a, let's say, a lot of amenities or whatever for its population, just dump 100,000 human or robots in the city and it'll just help anybody. Hey, can you help me carry this? Sure. You know, here you go. I'll put this in your car. And they're just cleaning. You know,
that's interesting. Like a pool, as opposed to a one-on-one ownership model, a pool of resources.
Yeah, a pool. Or like HOAs. You know, HOAs, like just they're doing all the work for, you know, there's a centralized delivery place where people can drop stuff off and the human robots can put in a robotaxi. And put, you know, there's just so many doors open for this thing. It's crazy.
It's interesting, a thought experiment, because you have a similar opportunity with robotaxis, which is this first thing of like, do I need to own a car when it's only driven less than 5% of the time?
Right, exactly.
95% of its time it's parked. What about a pool of, and we made our first leap obviously with urban folks who use Ubers, right? The average Uber has one person in it. The average car has 1.4 people in it. Like you shift from like a token ring network to a packet switch network by analogy. In other words, instead of thinking, oh, I need a bus, I need a train, I need to like make it efficient for large pools of people moving and try to coordinate all this human activity around catching the train or the bus. If it's actually more cost effective to have these 1 to 2 person vehicles shuffling around and doing all your work, then you have a series of packets that are in circulation versus a set of dedicated resources, the entire thing is so much more efficient. And that allows you to think about things like rental. So like your point about humanoids in Dubai or what have you, is rather than owning the thing, what if I'm using it when I need it? And oh, by the way, this could also extend to things that I might stockpile at home. Like how many batteries do you have sitting in a drawer? 9-volt batteries, AA batteries, AAA batteries.
Exactly.
Because such a pain in the ass when you don't have the one you need, right? And that plus, you know, any tool, I need a flathead screwdriver, I need a some whatever Torx wrench, depending on what you need. These could be like on demand brought to you by vehicles on a rental economy basis. Just like the vehicle itself is like on a usage basis, like driving as a service, robotics as a service, inventory as a service to say like, you know, some kind of drone like thing is bringing me what I need on demand within less than 40 minutes of any request I may put to it. Why stockpile stuff at home?
Exactly. Yeah. And then on the human or robot front, like once it learns a job, all the bots know that job. And then over time, all the bots will do all the jobs.
Federated learning. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yep. You know, so it's just, man. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be wild.
Exactly.
It's going to be wild. Steve, thank you so much for joining me, man. I really enjoyed this conversation. Where can people find you? Is there anything you'd like to bring attention to from your side?
Well, I'm online. I have a really sick addiction to social media, so mainly on X. Future Jurvetson there. Whoever has Jurvetson, please give it back to me. Anyway, Future Jurvetson. Future Ventures is our company name, so I had to pick something that could be memorable. Future.Ventures is our website. For any entrepreneurs out there that want to change the world for the better, we love investing in the bold, audacious people who want to change the world for the better and ideally are doing something unlike anything we've seen before. That's our filter for what we invest in. So love to, you know, speak with, meet, and invest in, you know, the best and the brightest that are building a better future.
Awesome. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely.
Thank you.